This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
In preparation of Purim this year, let's have a look at the Megillah from a fresh perspective. We know what the Megillah is about, both in its the sense of the theme of its story, and its deeper meaning, the demonstration of how Hashem sets miracles up to take place in the background, not always very obviously apparent to us. Sometimes takes a while for it to play out before we really understand the enormity of the miracle that is unfolding before us. All of that we're fairly familiar with, and as we work through the Megillah in this series, we'll notice those things too. But I want to look at the Megillah from a very different perspective and see a sub-theme that has just so much to teach us. And that really is the nature of the relationship between Ahasuerus and the women in his life, in this case, first Vashti and then Esther, and the relationship between Mordechai and Esther. And again, this is going to be a fairly short series, so we're not going to go into it in massive detail, but I'm hoping to be able to stimulate a different angle for you, so that as you read the Megillah, hear the Megillah, learn the Megillah, using some of the insights of these shiurim, it will open up some interesting thoughts for you and serve as a springboard for discussion and reflection that might take you to new places. And if we then start at the at chapter 1, and that's all we'll do in this particular shiur, is look at the first parak, and here we see the enormity of the power, the grandeur, the glory that Ahasuerus actually has, certainly from the perspective of the politics of his life, of the degree to which he is statesman and king and master over a vast empire. That's very, very clear in the opening passages. What contrasts with that enormity of power is his inability to assert his authority even over his own wife, in this case Vashti. Somehow it just didn't work. His normal instruments of power didn't seem to work to get his own wife to do his will. So let's have a look at some of the verses. The Megillah opens, in fact, before I get into the detail of the opening of the Megillah, one of the principles we'll use as we go through the Megillah is a principle that Chazal talk about, which is that there are times when Ahasuerus is referred to as Hamelech, the king, and there are times when he is referred to as Hamelech Ahasuerus, King Ahasuerus. And there is a difference, a very important difference, that enables us to unwrap different levels of meaning in the Megillah as we go through. When it says Hamelech Ahasuerus, that we're told means King Ahasuerus did that particular action from his own perspective, his own desire. This was Ahasuerus acting as Ahasuerus. When it says Hamelech, and it doesn't say Ahasuerus, that is Ahasuerus acting as an agent of Hashem. Hamelech then means not just the king being the king Ahasuerus, but Hamelech then means the king, the Ribono Shel Olam. That doesn't mean God is doing the acting, it's Ahasuerus who does the acting, but he's acting in his capacity as a tool of God and not as an independent agent. And we'll see that acting out even in the first chapter. We start off being told, in the very first sentence, he's not even referred to as Hamelech, or Hamelech Ahasuerus. There's a level of discourtesy in the way he's introduced to us in the very first sentence, a lack of the grandeur which becomes clear later on. Vayehi bimei Ahasuerus, and it was in the times of, not of King Ahasuerus, or just it was in the time of Ahasuerus. Hu Ahasuerus, that is the same Ahasuerus, Hamolech mihodu vad kushel v'esumeyom, you know, who ruled from India through to Ethiopia, 127 states in all. Almost a sense of, can you believe that the Megillah seems to be saying? That's the Ahasuerus. That is the man who actually ruled over these 127 states. He was just Ahasuerus. He wasn't even a real king. Rashi tells us, in fact, that he arose himself. He wasn't descended from kings. He appointed himself. He was self-anointed, self-appointed. So there is something inauthentic in his regality. There is an insecurity in his regality. It doesn't sit comfortably with him. And in this we see a really important leadership lesson. The danger of a leader whose leadership doesn't sit comfortably with him or her. A leader who's not authentic. A leader who isn't leading from within themselves. And so we're told, set up that way, right in the first sentence, he's just Ahasuerus, he's just an ordinary man, Ahasuerus, who found himself in the position of king, placed himself in the position of king over this vast state. And we'll see his insecurities starting to act out from the very beginning. What does a person do who's very insecure? The first thing is they do is they brag about that which they're insecure about. They're very ostentatious about it. They want everybody to see and approve, desperate for the approval of others. So it was in those days, we're told in the second verse, when that king Ahasuerus was sitting on his throne at the height of his power in Shushan HaBira, the third year after he'd taken over as king, that he made this massive party, this banquet, this celebration. For what purpose? We're told in verse 4, Baharoto et Osher Kavod Malchuto, to demonstrate in the most ostentatious way the wealth of the glory of his kingdom, Ve'et Yekar Tiferet Gdulato, and the majesty of his clothing and the way he presented himself and positioned himself. For many days, 180 days, he conducted the celebration to really impose his status on his people, on his subjects. And then, when that period of time is done, he makes a more intimate party. 7 days for the people who found living in Shushan, the capital, great and small. These are the people that he now really depends on for their approval and their support. They're people who occupy the capital. And here, interestingly, unlike the first party, where we're told the party was made by HaMelech Ahasuerus, so he just did that of his own desire, wasn't orchestrated by God, so to say. Of course, everything that happens in life has God behind it. But that was a choice that he made and didn't have any kind of divine meaning. But the second party, in verse 5, Uvimlot Hayamim Ha'ele, after this time it had completed itself, the 180 days, the king made a party for 7 days. The king, Hashem. That doesn't mean Hashem made the party again. It's Ahasuerus who made the party. But here he's acting as an agent. Because this particular party then becomes the platform on which the setting is constructed for the downfall of Vashti. And of course the downfall of Vashti facilitates the entrance of Esther. And before the whole story can unwind, Hashem sets up the solution and sets up the place for Esther to come before anything else untoward happens. So this party, the second party, was the party where God's hand is already playing out. So here in verse 5, it's Asah HaMelech L'chol HaAmanim, the king, Hashem, through his agent Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus as agent of God, makes this party for 7 days. Bechatzar ginat bitan hamelech. Now, interesting again, he does this in the yard, in the garden, the treed, beautiful landscaped garden of Hamelech, not Hamelech Ahasuerus. This once again is the garden of the king, which means that when Ahasuerus built this garden, he was doing so also inspired and triggered by Hashem himself. This wasn't just his own urge to build a garden. Hashem wanted that garden because, don't forget, further on in the story, that garden plays a really important part. When the king finds Haman all over Esther and he gets really angry, he begins to, he goes out for a walk to compose himself in the garden, and that's where he formulates some of his plans that lead to the ultimate downfall of Haman. So the the little yard, that little garden in which this party took place, was something that takes is a part of the divine plan. It's Hamelech. This is not just King Ahasuerus. This is part of the divine plan itself. And so the story develops, and Hashem wants this party to deconstruct in a sense, and to really degenerate. And if we look at that, we see that's beginning to happen. These descriptions of very ostentatious demonstrations of wealth, v'hashkot b'chlei zahav v'chelim mikelim shonim, and drink in golden utensils and many different utensils and vessels, and as we know, some of those in fact came from the temple service. The yain malchut rav, and the wine of the kingdom was much, kiyad hamelech, according to the generous hand of the king. Again, not Hamelech Achashverosh. The reason that the wine poured so freely was not only Achashverosh's decision that that's how it should be, but God is beginning to play it out. The drunkenness of the king becomes a really important theme here. Vashdiyah kadat en ones in verse 8, everybody is free to drink. Kichen yisad hamelech, once again, because that's what the king had established, that everybody could drink. La'asot kirtzon ish v'ish, to allow the will of each person to be done. So here we see not only the free flow of wine, but something else is introduced here by Hamelech, once again, Hashem himself. The king is incredibly eager to please. La'asot kirtzon ish v'ish, to do whatever anybody wants of him to do. He really is playing to them. Now don't forget, in those days, kings were not democratically elected, and that was part of their strength and the weakness of the system. The fact that they were not democratically elected meant that if they weren't moral people and ethical people, they had no level of accountability to the nation. On the other hand, the fact that they weren't elected gave them independence. So the pursuit of popularity was something that in those days was not a function of ruling. Ruling was meant to be doing the right thing for the nation. Sometimes it became doing corrupt things for the interests of the king himself. But never was the intention that a king would need to pander to the will of the nation in ways that modern governments have to do in order to stay in power. But Ahasuerus did. Once again, we see the insecurity of the man. Yes, he's a king, but he knows very well that regality that is his is not authentically his and doesn't sit that comfortably. And so he finds within himself the need to really please other people and to pander to them. And in this, we begin to see the loss, or the slow, perhaps not so slow, erosion of Ahasuerus' dignity. And thereby his loss of stature. Because one of the things we're going to be looking at here is comparing the tools and trappings of status with the real, authentic regality of true stature. And to say, to rule a nation, yes, one can rule a nation with power, with control, with abuse, with fear, using the status of one's office, in this case the king, or one can rule a nation with one's personal stature and with one's dignity. People will follow leaders either because they fear them or because they trust them. If they fear them, it's not the individual that they fear that much as the power of that individual status. If there is trust, then what they're following is really the stature of that individual, not his status. Once again, a general leadership principle we have here, an idea that one can lead with power and fear and status, and one can lead with personal stature and authority and dignity. The interesting thing is that those are two ways one can lead an organization, they're two ways one can lead a nation. But to lead a wife, and here we come to the soul of the relationship issue in Megillat Esther, because Megillat Esther is a book about a woman, a highly influential woman, It is a book about the relationship between that woman and various very powerful men. Two in particular, a man whose power was vested in his status, Achashverosh, and a man whose power was vested in his stature, Mordechai. And as powerful as Achashverosh is in terms of his status and his ability to instill fear, unable he was to achieve the fellowship of his own wife. And we're going to see that that was simply a loss of dignity. When a man wants to inspire his wife and his family to follow him, it's not going to be effective if that's done through status and legislation and fear. The only way that can be done is when a person functions within his family from a position of great stature and great dignity. What are the things that erode dignity? When does a man lose his dignity? Well, the one, Pirkei Avot really tells us when a person loses their dignity. The three things by which you can judge a person. See a person bekiso, bekoso, bekaso. See him with the way he uses his money or his power. See him with drink. And see him in anger. Here we see that Achashverosh, the king, is demonstrated already in this first chapter to lose dignity by losing independence of thought. Independence of thought is lost when we're drunk. When a person loses their judgment, they lose independence of thought. Drunkenness would be one of the ways that we lose independence of thought, and with that loss of independence of thought, we lose our dignity and we lose our stature. The second is anger, when we lose our tempers. We lose our independence of thought. We lose dignity when we've lost our temper, and we lose stature. The third one is actually a quest for popularity. When a person begins to do things just to gain the approval of others, rather than because he or she believes that is the right thing to be doing. When we're pandering for the approval and popularity of other people, those are times that we run the risk of loss of independence, loss of dignity, and loss of stature. And all of these three things happen in this first chapter. It's in this first chapter that Achashverosh does become drunk, and all of his guests too. It is in this chapter that his downfall is his desire to do what other people tell him to do, his quest for popularity. And it is in this chapter that he loses his temper, that he gets angry. So let's see this play out. In verse 9, Vashti was also making a party, and was on the seventh day, Ketov Lev HaMelech B'Yayin, when the king was touched by the drink and was somewhat drunk. So here we have the beginning of the loss of independent thought. He's allowed himself to act in ways that demonstrate a loss of dignity and a loss of stature. He says to Mahuman, the others around him, that he wants Vashti to be brought before him in her crown of glory, in her royal crown. Why did he want her? Did he want her there to honor her, or did he want her there to show her off as some kind of a possession, something that he owned? And that's clearly the case, because we're told in verse 11 exactly why he wanted her. Laharot ha'amim v'hasarim et yofiyah. He wanted to show off her beauty to the princes and the leaders of the nations. Ki tovat marehi, because she was very beautiful. That she was beautiful, that the Tanakh mentions, certainly not in any kind of a negative sense, but Achashverosh's desire to use her beauty as a sex object, as an object to demonstrate his own power, that's the beginning of the abusiveness of that relationship. Instead of honoring her, he's using her, he's abusing her. And the result of that, and again, this is not just a story of Achashverosh and Esther, this is a story of the erosion of honor in any relationship. When a man begins to see his relationship to his wife as one of power and possession, then Vatima'el Hamalka, even though she's the queen in verse 12, she refuses to come. She doesn't respond to him anymore. She ceases to respond to him. She's lost respect for him. She doesn't see him as a man of dignity. She doesn't see him as a man of majesty. Yes, he's king over 127 states, but he uses his status and his power as a human being, as a man. He's a midget, a cripple of a human being. And she sees that in the way he treats her. She sees that in the way he abuses her. She sees that in the way he's handling her himself. And she wants no part of that, doesn't buy into it, and refuses to come. What does the king do? Now we have the situation of the leader of great ego and status and very little security and true sense of self. the man who's totally insecure in his position of power, even though it's ultimate power, tries in front of others to assert his authority over his own wife and fails publicly. Vayiktzof HaMelech, of course, what does an egotistical person do when he's shown to be small and insignificant and meaningless and a midget as far as character is concerned? Vayiktzof, he gets angry, he loses his temper. So he starts off drunk, now he's lost his temper, once again a further deterioration in his level of independence of thought and independence of action. The Chamato Barabo, and he was burning with anger. And he turns to his advisors as to what to do. And once again, we see him unable to act on his own accord, but turning to his advisors in order to know what should be done. Memuchan jumps into the fray. We're told that Memuchan is none other than Haman himself, and declares that Vashti has not only undermined the authority of the king, but she's done so for everybody in the kingdom, and she's damaged the relationship between men and women. And he says something so telling. Ki yetzei devar hamalka al kol hanashim, because the actions of the words of the queen go out among all the other women. He says in verse 17, lahavzot ba'aleihim ba'enehem, to disgrace their husbands in their eyes, when they tell the story over, that, you know what, Ahasuerus called on Vashti and she refused to come. If Vashti was able to refuse the authority of the king, what woman would show any kind of authority towards a man? So let's pause there a moment and say, okay, so what's to be done about that? If we're really worried about the deterioration of the social relationships between men and women, between husbands and wives, what really ought to be done? And in terms of the way we've explained it, what clearly needs to be done is men need to build some more stature. Men need to stop abusing their wives. Men need to stop using their wives as status symbols and start using them or treating them as objects of great honor and dignity. That's what really would have to happen in order to reinstitute and reinforce a woman's commitment and respect for her husband. No, says Haman, let's rather execute Vashti and instill even more fear and legislate the need for a woman to respect her husband. And the result of that, he says in verse 20, is Chol Anashim Yitnu Yekar LeBa'aleihem, when all the women will show honor to their husbands, Migadol Ve'ad Katan, whether their husbands are big or small. It's so telling. If we can instill enough fear in the women, we will be sure that even little men who have little character and no stature will be able to have honor at home, because their wives will be afraid to treat them any other way. And so here we see, it's almost comical and rather pathetic, because we see so much of this in real life too, where a man insists, you will respect me, you will show me respect. A man trying to use the force of his power on legislating respect. What is that respect really worth? What is the respect worth of a woman who is doing so out of fear, that feels nothing else? Well, I suppose for a person of very small self-worth and a whole lot of ego, that's fine, as long as you show me the respect, even if it's for no real deep reason. it's valuable to them, but surely that's not what we want. But for Ahasuerus, he liked the idea. He liked the idea, and he immediately sent out statements and laws that every man should be a ruler in his home, and should be free to speak the language of his nation, so that if the woman coming into the home is a foreigner, if she's not familiar, it's for her to learn his family's language and not necessary for he to learn her languages. Interesting. So here once again, the real point of the honor and dignity that a woman shows to her husband in an almost natural way, if the relationship is right, being wrecked and ruined by legislating it by law and using the power and the forcefulness of state. And so once again, in summary, this powerful king Ahasuerus, unable to exert his authority over his own wife, the reason being that he'd completely lost his dignity, he'd lost his independence of thought, he'd become drunk, he'd become dependent on other people and dependent on popularity rather than on decisiveness and any sense of moral stature, and he'd in fact lost his temper. She loses all respect for him, disobeys him, and instead of an individual looking inwards and saying, what is wrong with me and my relationship with my wife that she seems to have lost respect for me? What can I do to change that? And the knee-jerk response being, I'll enforce it. She jolly well will show me the respect that I demand. She's my wife and she has to do that. And so we try and legislate that respect. Something we need to be so careful about, when we lose the respect of others, that's a telling red light for us. That's such an important opportunity of growth for us. And we need to do everything we can to learn from that opportunity and to look inwards and say, if people are losing respect for me, I'm not acting with independence of thought. I'm not demonstrating dignity and stature, because if I were, people would be respecting me. The level of respect that we feel from others is one of the finest indicators of the degree of stature and dignity with which we function. Unless, of course, people respect us just because we occupy an office. People respect us because we're the boss. People respect us because we're the CEO. They respect us because we're the teacher or the rabbi or the husband. Then, of course, respect tells us nothing about ourselves. It becomes a useless barometer. It becomes a barometer that has no value. Why am I being shown respect because I occupy a position of status? That tells me nothing. But if I can inspire respect without my status, that tells me a whole lot about the way I'm functioning and enables me to see myself in the mirror and to get immediate feedback the moment I'm losing the respect of others because of a lack of dignity and stature with which I'm operating. That's the opening chapter of the Megillah. And in the next session, we'll take those themes a little further.